on Saturday, the 2nd of May at 2:30 in the Great Room of St. John's College, giving a lecture titled The U.S. Response to the New Russia. Ambassador Pickering, you're giving this lecture, The U.S. Response to the New Russia. What is meant by the New Russia?
It's interesting because it was a choice of the folks in Santa Fe. But for me, the new Russia is the Russia after the Soviet Union, including not only Putin and Medvedev, but also Mr. Yeltsin's period.
So say more about that. I mean, the contrast between the Soviet and the post-Soviet period is huge. But what specifically happened?
Well, two or three things of great importance happened. One was, of course, the fall of communism. Secondly, was high expectations about a growth of freedom and democracy, which were not met. Thirdly, was the recentralization of Russia under Mr. Putin's period. And fourthly, is now a transition in Russia taking place toward a situation in which either Mr. Putin will succeed himself or is with Mr. Medvedev in between, or we'll move down a line of succession of other leaders, and obviously that will determine a lot of what happens. Most immediately is the fact that after a very, very bad patch over the last 6 or 8 years, the Obama administration has attempted to open the door, I think quite successfully, on a new period with Russia in which we have to address some very important problems that represent common interests, including things like nuclear disarmament, what to do about the future of the START Treaty, the future of the World Trade Organization and Russian membership, and many other things.
So the conditions in Russia today are both different from and similar to the way they were during the Cold War in certain senses in relation to the United States. On the one hand, we're no longer ideological enemies, and we both, on some level, have a capitalist system. On the other hand, we still have large numbers of nuclear weapons pointed at each other. Where do we find ourselves? Why are we still doing this weapons thing?
Well, I think in part it's the hangover of the Cold War, and it's not easy, I think, to give up a set of relationships in which deterrence plays a very important role in producing what I would call a sense of security and even stability. And so we are now engaged in a period in which we can take a look at another set of reductions of nuclear weapons and delivery vehicles to move down toward the goal, which President Obama and President Medvedev have both articulated, of seeking a world without nuclear weapons. Most of us think that will take a considerable period of time and a lot of ingenuity. But in the meantime, moving down that ladder is not necessarily very easy. But if we do it together and we do it jointly and we have considerable inspection and monitoring so that we're sure that, in fact, it's going well, then my view is that brings about more stability and obviously moves us in the right direction.
There are so many different ways to think about stability, and one of them is economic stability, as a lot of people are experiencing these days especially. And of course, when you spend, as the Soviet Union did and the United States too, masses and masses of the people's money on weapons rather than on, you know, schools and healthcare and jobs and so on, that has its own kind of instability. So there, it gets complicated.
It does. Happily, each side is not proposing new massive increases in weapons and is taking an active look right now at how, in fact, they can reduce the existing weapon systems. That doesn't save a lot of money in terms of big new investment because it's not there, but it does, over a period of time, save us some money in the maintenance of those weapons and the continued support for them.
What was the nature of your own involvement in Russia during your career as a diplomat and beyond?
I was in Russia only once as a diplomat. I was ambassador to Russia from 1993 until 1996. I began in Russia actually in May of 1993, and I ended my term of service in the end of November 1996.
And what was that like for you? What did you do? What did you see?
Well, it was a time of fascinating change, and obviously things were quite unsettled. People in Russia were struggling with hunger in some cases, with great change in their own system, with the loss in the value of their money, with changing world circumstances, some very bright spots. In a sense, the secret police didn't come tapping at night anymore. People could speak up. The newspapers and the television had things on it that were never reported before. So this was a combination of change, some of adversity and some obviously of great benefit. And we were trying to help the Russians adjust to this change and continue to move in the direction which we considered to be positive toward a freer, more open market on the one hand and toward the use of more democracy in their governance on the other.
So capitalism in Russia, of course, hasn't worked out well for everyone. The rich have gotten extremely rich, and there's, again, a great deal of inequality in Russia, which, of course, we have here in the United States, too. How do you address the role of economics in foreign relations?
Well, it's a very important question. It's difficult in foreign relations to help another country to prescribe its future economic policies. But insofar as we could tell the Russians, there are certain principles that are important that you should keep your eye on. And how you implement them is really your own business because it affects your own politics and therefore is significant in terms of decision-making by Russian leaders. Those kinds of approaches work. In addition, we have a set of rules and things like trade and how to handle foreign currency and how to make loans across international borders and all of those kinds of things that are not just American rules. They happen to be broadly accepted by the international community. And we have obviously worked hard with the Russians, and others have too, to bring them along with those rules, sometimes successfully and sometimes not successfully. But Russia is a big country, a very proud one, with a great history. And it likes the idea of making its own decisions. And it's kind of happy now that with the great benefits that oil income have brought to the Russians in recent years, they can be, in effect, in their own view, more independent of what others prescribe for them.
It's interesting when you speak about helping the Russians, or indeed, you know, as an ambassador does, or as an American presence in another country does, help other countries to get better, to work on their economic policy and other kinds of freedoms and so on. Do we accept the same or think we need the same kind of help from other countries?
Not normally, and I think that's a shortcoming. It was very interesting that I can remember one incident where I took a group of American educators to the Russian education ministry, and they were all run mad, as they should have been, to help the Russians with new textbooks on things like democracy and civics and modern economics. And I suggested in the meeting, it went over like a lead balloon, that maybe we should take a very careful look at Russian textbooks on mathematics and on science, where they're teaching levels seemingly on the basis of the accomplishment of their students were well above ours. So the two-way street works. It has possibilities. It takes a while to sell it, and Americans are as proud as Russians with respect to accepting help from other people.
I was listening to a lecture that you gave, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I remember you're saying was that your father was a salesman, and he taught you that it was as important to listen as to speak, and that you really could bring that kind of attitude into diplomacy.
Yes, it's very important. I think I always used to say diplomats get paid the same amount of money for listening as speaking, and they ought to do it in the ratio of one-third speaking to two-thirds listening.
Is the process of diplomacy set up in a way that happens and that it happens in a mutual manner?
Sometimes. It depends on the personalities. It often depends upon the exigencies of the moment. It depends upon the degree to which people feel under pressure to try to accomplish objectives, and it also depends on personal style. So like selling things, sometimes diplomacy can follow in the same patterns, and indeed I found a lot of similarities, as I said, in the lecture you referred to, and as I've said in other lectures.
We're speaking with Ambassador Thomas Pickering, who is going to be visiting Santa Fe this weekend, Saturday, May 2nd, 2:30. It's a lecture sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. So how would you describe and evaluate the Bush administration's 8 years in terms of United States-Russian relations?
But I think that, to be fair and honest, we've had some very rough patches. I think that it's not exclusively the fault of anyone. Now, the Russians have a long series of complaints, and we do too. I think what we missed, which is something that the present administration is trying to bring back, There's the effort on part of both sides to work at high levels to find areas where we shared mutual interests and where, in fact, we could, by working together through diplomacy, develop what we would all call, in our business at least, win-win solutions. And that faded away for a while. I think in part there was a lack of interest, and in part there was a lack of realization that in order to maintain and strengthen a relationship, and it's just the way you have in a good marriage, people have to find common interests they're prepared to work together on to overcome the usual negative problems which crop up in any kind of relationship of that sort. And if you allow the negatives to dominate the relationships, you're in a downward spiral. If you can find a way to have the positives offset that, then somehow I believe you can contain the negatives and indeed make progress on the negatives as you move ahead, because both sides are invested in the relationship and making it work.
Talk more about Putin as a leader. What was he like for the Russian people, just in Russian terms, and how was he as a leader who dealt with other countries like the United States?
Well, people saw him as fresh, new, young, someone who was the antithesis of Yeltsin, who put him there. They saw him as clever. They saw him as somebody who was not afraid to be tough and powerful. And indeed, there is a longstanding admiration in Russia historically for power, for what the Russians call vlast. And he filled that niche pretty well and got a lot of popularity. He stood up for what he thought about and thought Russia ought to do. He made changes in the Russian system to re-centralize it, which I think helped with a number of Russians, whereas the Americans were kind of aghast. He took over good pieces of the free press, which disturbed us, but disturbed the Russians less, because the Russians are congenitally deeply worried about disorder and indeed problems of disintegration and difficulties that civil war and internal strife may bring. They are, I think, in that sense, closer to those elemental factors of individuals' existence and survival than we luckily are in our own country, except in historical times of great crisis, which we had a tendency right now to put into the past. So the approach of the population is different, and therefore the approach to the leader is different. But Putin was kind of a semi-ideal Russian leader for the Russian domestic public. And, of course, Putin understood this and played it very well. And Putin, like a lot of Russian leaders, tended to give preeminence to domestic issues over foreign policy, and indeed even used foreign policy and sometimes a more dogmatic position on foreign policy to promote his domestic popularity, something that's not unknown in the United States historically as well.
How are they dealing with inequality, which, with all the other problems that you had during the Soviet period, was less of a problem than it is now or than it was before?
Well, I would say, first, the Soviet period had rampant inequality, masked by an ideology that that preached equality but practiced huge inequality. The party was massively preferred. Apparatchiks, people in what was called the nomenklatura, the list of leading party people, got tremendous advantages, whereas ordinary people, including the hardworking proletariat, were left far behind. Some of that is leveled off, although not entirely, and of course you have the oligarchs, who have become rich very, very rapidly, but who went through a difficult period with Putin, who wanted to be sure that they knew and understood that if they had become rich economically, he wouldn't question the way in which they became rich if they, in fact, didn't try to impose themselves politically on him. This is one of the difficulties Mr. Putin and Mr. Khodorkovsky had, the former head of Yukos, who's now in jail.
Right.
And there are obviously serious differences between the two, and Mr. Putin demonstrated that by being leader of the government, he could triumph over somebody who had amassed a very, very large fortune. I think Mr. Khodorkovsky underestimated that.
Let's go back through the early part of the 20th century. All this energy devoted toward the Russian Revolution, which at the time was infinitely hopeful and even inspired people in Europe and in the United States. And then you had Stalinism, in which twice as many people were killed as under Hitler. What are the legacies of that long and difficult period, the revolution and then the bloodbath that followed and then the Soviet period during the later part of the Cold War, culturally on the people of Russia and diplomatically today?
Well, I think one thing you have to know is that under the czars, everything was not simply hunky-dory as well. There were central authorities, that there were secret police, and indeed things were also quite difficult. So Russians have not lived in a period of openness for a long period of time. And anybody who believes that Lenin was a total angel is obviously not in touch with history. Stalin developed it much further and became much more oppressive in a massive way and was, in our view, a gigantic ogre. He also made enormous mistakes in terms of having to understand what Germany, Nazi Germany, was all about, and I think was genuinely shocked by the German military invasion of Russia and acted that way for a long period of time. Over a period of time since Stalin's death, people have had a tendency to forgive some of that in a strange way and see Stalin as a consolidator of Russian power in the Soviet Union and someone who developed nuclear weapons and indeed put Russia or the Soviet Union then in the first rank of world nations. And so this is a strange picture, but Mr. Putin at times has expressed his admiration for Stalin, something we certainly do not and will never share.
I mean, when you think about Stalin and Hitler and just vast amounts of literature and film and discussion and thinking and really pain that has taken place in the diaspora after World War II and what Hitler did in Germany, it seems that, I mean, does that exist within Russia? Do you have the survivors of Stalinism talking about it?
I think so. You certainly had, of course, those people we called refuseniks, who in Brezhnev's time and Khrushchev's time wanted to change the system and gradually grew more powerful and indeed had a serious influence. I think also Mr. Gorbachev understood and realized that communism, as he inherited, could not be perpetuated. Having talked to him on a number of occasions, I have the idea that he wanted to reform communism rather than move toward capitalism and an open and more democratic system. But nevertheless, change was coming, and my own view is that the Russian economy aided that change by collapsing. It collapsed in part because the Russians could no longer afford guns and butter. While that's a very simple statement, it played a significant role in the end of communism.
We're talking to Ambassador Thomas Pickering. So this is a question that I've always wanted to ask an ambassador, and excuse the possible impertinence of this question, but how do you, when you're a diplomat, think about the relationship between what the people of your country want and what the government wants? In other words, if the head of the State Department has one policy and that's at odds with the people of the United States, is there conversation? How do you think about that?
Well, we think about it a lot. We use, in fact, our own best interests in terms of our experience, our background, our expertise to suggest changes when several things occur. When we feel our policy isn't working, when we feel it's out of keeping with American values, indeed with America, without of keeping with American aspirations, and often when proposals and suggestions are made inside the system of making foreign policy, we believe we have an obligation, obviously, to make sure that what foreign policies are recommended and accepted are in keeping with our values and aspirations, which we feel are generally supported by the people. We don't have a special mechanism except by looking at polling data and listening in an anecdotal sense to what spokesmen for the people have to say as to exactly what the people think about a particular policy. But I can assure you that when a policy is decided on, it is extremely important to the State Department and indeed to the White House to explain those policies to the people of the United States in terms that they will understand and hopefully in terms that are congruent with their aspirations and indeed with our historic position in terms of our policies and in terms of our principles and indeed our Constitution and those kinds of things that have guided us over the centuries.
During the last 8 years, one thing that has been fairly consistent is the dominance of the Defense Department over the State Department. Do you, in terms of how policy is made and enacted, do you see a change under the Obama administration?
I do. I think that the dominance has been more in the use of the Defense Department as the preferred instrument of national of exerting our national will. And necessarily, it has been the dominance of the Defense Department in policymaking, but both have certainly played a role. I think we have now learned that force is vitally necessary for successful diplomacy, but force should always be used as a last resort when there are no other opportunities to deal with the problem, unless, of course, we're being directly attacked, and then that's a different position. My sense is that we lost sight of a lot of that over the last 8 years, and we had a tendency to believe, I think totally misplaced in my view, that force could help us solve a lot of problems very quickly, where diplomacy might take a longer period of time. And of course, we lost sight of the fact that the world is populated by many other countries. They have views that often we cannot do all of these things ourselves without the help and assistance of other people. And so we are now back to a situation in which there is, I would think, an increased and important new interest in diplomacy, and particularly away from unilateralism and toward multilateralism, and certainly away from the use of force and toward being able to find ways through persuasion, indeed the better ideas that hopefully we and others can come forward with to bring others along in a situation where they are vitally necessary partners to accomplish a specific objective. We don't live in a world alone, and nobody has ever anointed us to be the sole director of the world. We have to, by our leadership and our persuasive powers, get there. And I think that's certainly something that, once again, we've realized as being vitally necessary.
Also, I think that many Americans, though certainly not all, are coming to understand that we don't do the best job in everything. We don't do the best job environmentally, in healthcare, in education, and having a lot of guns doesn't make us better.
I think that's right, and I think that the important point for us is that we have contributed a lot to the world, but we've also drawn a lot from the world. And I think that if our leadership is a leadership among partners, where in effect those with the persuasive powers to put forward the best and most innovative ideas and to find ways to bring people together around those ideas are expected to lead, then we have a real vocation in doing that. But we shouldn't misplace that for something that says immutably the United States will always be the most important player, and therefore everybody has to do everything we think should be done. We need to have, obviously, very capable people serving our country in the critical jobs that are required to bring people, other governments, and now increasingly people in the private and non-governmental sector along with the directions in which we want to go. But we also have, over the years, learned to work with our friends and allies quietly, often, to both persuade them of the direction which we're going, but also to absorb their thinking and their contribution and their ideas. And that's been part of our diplomacy for some time. I think it's now back in the center of our diplomacy. And my hope is that through more powerful and persuasive and indeed more perceptive leadership, we can continue, obviously, to play a very significant role in the world.
Do you have a role in, at this point, I mean, you're a retired career ambassador with a great deal of experience, in influencing the Obama administration or the Clinton State Department in any way?
Well, I think, of course, I retired at the end of the Clinton administration. So as the number three person in the State Department, I did have a role. I've been retired since then. From time to time, I've been asked for my views. From time to time, I've volunteered them. Those in the Obama State Department who make the decisions would have to answer your question. But my feeling is that through participation in Washington in many study groups and in many panels, and indeed being engaged, I and others have had the very positive effort of putting on the table a lot of new ideas and a lot of new departures and that kind of thing. Those have been picked up or not picked up, depending upon how the administrations have seen them over time. As somebody once said, successful policy has 1,000 fathers, and failure looks to one person to accept accountability.
Right, right. What do you think are the very most important things that the Clinton State Department and the Obama administration should do in terms of having good relations with Russia?
Well, I think that they need now to pursue the opening that President Obama has made with President Medvedev, that we need in a number of areas, as many of them having to do with nuclear weapons and disarmament and nonproliferation, to pursue the negotiations which will shortly begin to preserve the START Treaty, to look ahead at a new round of reductions in nuclear weapons and delivery vehicles, to examine the possibility of future cooperation on ballistic missile defense, to look at the future of nonproliferation and see how we can contribute, perhaps through an international fuel regime. The United States ought to, in my view, ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. We ought to work closely with the Russians to bring into effect a fissile material cutoff treaty, which will, in effect, ratify the moratorium that exists among the five nuclear powers not to make fissile material for use in nuclear weapons. That we ought to go with the Russians and find an answer to their membership in the WTO, something that's been negotiated now for 15 years, that we ought to build up our business relationships and our contacts. We ought to have conversations about some of the neuralgic and difficult issues of what are we doing and what the Russians consider their near abroad, what are they conceiving for their own role in their near abroad. There are important issues, obviously, that we need to discuss on a reciprocal basis with respect to what the Russians are doing in places like Cuba or Venezuela. Those are all important to us. So there's a huge agenda. It's a very broad one. It's a very useful one. And I think that there are many things ahead for the two countries that can, in fact, find a way to add much more positive to the quotient. And finally, I think it would be a good idea for both countries to appoint a very senior figure to lead this work, so that it is coordinated, that is closely reflects the president's ideas and objectives, and in fact, it brings all of the elements of the U.S. government into play to help to try to make these policies a success.
Ambassador Thomas Pickering is a career ambassador, and he's been Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, President of the Eurasia Foundation, and representative to the United Nations. And his lecture this Saturday, May 2nd at 2:30, is titled The U.S. Response to the New Russia. It's in the great room of St. John's College here in Santa Fe. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. You can go for more information to sfcir.org or call 505-982-4931. Ambassador Pickering, thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you like, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz celebrates its 9th anniversary and features a visit from trumpet star Ingrid Jensen. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.